we talked about the Spirit, just in general, defining what the Holy Spirit was, and the Holy Spirit acting as kind of the power of shalom in the world. And looking at that power of shalom, that peacemaking, I was taking my base from Paul Tillich's book, Love, Power, and Justice. Last Wednesday, we got into looking at love and power. Maybe I'll just run over those quickly, because they're all going to be intertwined, and today we'll handle justice, and then how they're all united in personal relations, and then also in group relations. Remember that we mentioned that love is not a mere emotion, although it can involve emotion. It's basically that which reunites the estranged. And what we said to that which unites the separated, and that we as individuals, since we're so individual, so for ourselves, are the ones that are the most estranged, the most separated from other people. But at the same time, we're the people who are most capable of the greatest power of love, because we, every time we reach beyond ourselves, we're reuniting ourselves with other people's lives. And so in a sense, that's what love's about. And the anticipation of that union, that reunion with people and with groups of people, is oftentimes comes across as an emotion, you know, what we would usually label love. Okay, power, to continue down, is I'll be referring to it as the power of being, or the power of life itself, and the power that a person has to actualize that. Here I've got the dynamic self-affirmation of life, the drive to realize yourself with increasing intensity, realize what you're all about, make real your being, your life, and that being power. Within the whole talk about power, the one word that we mentioned, we were talking about force and coercion and compulsion. It's kind of, I think I mentioned the strange works that Luther refers to. Those parts of power that make way for us to practice things like love and self surrender. And I think that was the most controversial thing as far as defining that we came up to Wednesday, was that whole idea of coercion. And I hope we'll get into that a little more when we start talking about justice and how that all fits together. And then hopefully I would like to use these three as kind of the vision of peacemaking that I see necessary in the urban situation. And that'll be more, won't be so regimented as far as the rest of the kind of sessions have been going. If you have any questions, I guess we can spend a few minutes backtracking if need be. No spot. Okay, let's start with Jester. I'd also mentioned that I kind of always use this in the form of a triangle, just the three major parts and the interaction between love, power, and justice in every situation in our life, not just in acts of justice or acts of power and acts of love, but that they're all intertwined. You can't be powerful without, in a sense, referring to justice and love. But justice is the form of being. Here I've got the form of being of encounters. When two powers come together, a power might be an individual. When two powers come together, individual or corporate sense, justice is the form of that encounter. And so in some cases, there'll be unjust ways of encountering other people in the world, but we'll talk about that. It's the form in which which power of being or the power of life actualizes itself. That's how we finally land up doing or bringing letting our power out in the world, is in the form of justice. And that's risky. Justice gives forms to our encounters, and one of the risky things about justice is you can't decide justice before an encounter happens, but rather in the midst of an encounter. And sometimes that means things are going to come out unjust, and it may be even to the point of destroying something. And so we need to always be willing to reevaluate the justice, the form in which we carry out our power, so that our power isn't a destructive element in the world, but rather it's a creative element. Rather, it refers back to letting another person affirm their power, but also It's a reuniting experience.
Bridget. I'm not sure if I understand this quite right, but are you saying that that's sort of the situation we're talking about today was here, but we couldn't really decide that justice before we were in that situation? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that will be, because one of the principles I'll talk about in a little bit about combining justice and love is a need for us to consider adequacy. In other words, and a need to understand a specific context. That's where I think we'll be able to make some connections between what Dave Mason Brink said last week and this week, as knowing the context. Yeah, it's hard to, we can say what's just beforehand, but that's not really justice. That's kind of laying a trip on another context, and we have to watch out for that. But what I was getting at was that it's risky. Encounters are risky because the way in which we demonstrate our power and the way in which another person encounters us as another power, as another life, may turn out to be unjust. And we don't know that ahead of time. Sometimes we can blatantly tell that. That's why we have some rules and laws that try to show up a specific injustice. But for most parts, in personal encounters, it's hard to ahead of time decide what's just or unjust. One of the things about justice that I think is important to keep, and that's when we're going to talk about this adequacy, is that love can be used, this reuniting of the estranged, this reuniting of the separated, can be used as kind of a principle of justice. And that is it providing this kind of, is it providing for a reuniting of separated peoples? It is the form of the power that we exert and the other person exerts, allowing for reunion. And some of the principles involved in looking at that, the tie between love and justice, first is this whole idea of adequacy. Is the form, the way we act out our power, how does it fit into the context? The way we actualize our power in South Africa and the way we actualize our power in the United States, the way we actualize our power in a relationship between John and I, and the way that power is actualized in a relationship between Peter and I might be different. So we need to look at the adequacy of each situation, because elements will change and the strength and the power of individuals will change. And so the way we act that out is important. Another thing that's important when looking at justice and love combined is equality. And in some places, equality might mean that the blacks, it's equal to have the blacks at a lower position and the whites at a higher position, because they can't handle the progress and they can't handle civilization as the whites can. I'm making an example maybe there of South Africa. But when we're looking at equality, when we look at God's equality, God's justice, there's an ultimate equality there that doesn't separate people, but puts us again all on an equal kind of stage. And so that's another thing to consider when we're looking at justice. When we look at justice as a Christian, as a biblical person, we need to look at justice in the eyes of God's justice and the equality there. The other thing we need to look at, as far as a principle for love and justice being combined, is the whole idea of personality. And what I mean by that is to be able to see the other person, and this might also work in groups, to see the other person not as a mere thing, as an object that I use for my own benefit, or an object I use to get some attention toward myself, but rather we begin to see that person, the personality, as an individual, as a person who has power, as a person who demands justice and demands love from us. So we need to be able to see that also when we're dealing with justice and love together. The other thing that I finally would come to is the whole idea of liberty as a principle in justice. For a person to have the freedom to determine their own self-life, whether that might be political, to allow the people in El Salvador to determine their own self-government, their own self-history in the future, rather than superpowers, whichever side they might be on, putting their hands into it and adjusting it the way any superpower might want. So liberty there, meaning the freedom to let a person or a group of people demonstrate within a dynamic sense and realize themselves as people. And that's going to involve some, if it involves a power, it's also going to involve love and helping them to reunite what has been estranged, what has been taken away. So those are some four things about justice that I just wanted to kind of make as basic points in justice. Adequacy, equality, personality, and liberty. You can pause there for a minute if there's any question on that. Again, I think I always preface this whenever I read Tillich's book. For me, it has been a dynamic thing in the way I deal with issues of justice and peace. And the one way that it has most dramatically is in my prayer life. The oddest thing I thought would happen from reading a book by Paul Tillich would be that my prayer life would be enhanced. But it has, because I cannot sit down to prayer, I cannot walk in prayer anymore and not balance these three elements of love, power, and justice in relationship. It's a confronting dynamic mental exercise almost. So that, you know, that's one thing I just wanted to throw in there. One of the things about justice, to finally finish up a little bit about justice before getting into the unity of all these, is just the kinds of, the levels of justice there are. Basic to justice is that everything has an intrinsic claim, a very basic claim. I have a basic claim to justice. And that might mean everything from handicapped bathrooms to non-handicapped, physically handicapped bathrooms. The handicapped person, the one in the wheelchair, has a claim to justice, to actualize itself, a form that it needs to actualize itself, to unite us, to unite itself from being estranged. The handicapped person does need to have facilities that makes a person who is physically handicapped, makes it more of a possibility to actualize their power as a person. Whereas before we started making handicapped facilities available, it really was a detriment, in a sense, an injustice that if you're handicapped, you weren't allowed to be in this bathroom, in a sense, because you couldn't fit your chair through the door. Because how do you get into the toilet when there's nothing to hold on to? And so maybe when we turn to try to provide things for the handicapped, the physically handicapped, we need to look at that as a form of justice in which a person or people are allowed to realize their power of life to the fullest that it possibly can evolve. One of the other levels of justice is proportional justice, probably a very familiar form of justice, in that you get what you deserve, positively or negatively. If you do the wrong things, it's negative. If you do the positive things, it's a more of a positive experience. And the last form of justice that I want to center on the most, and I guess which is the foundation of the justice that I'm looking at here, is creative justice. And it's based on the whole idea that a person's claim or a group's claim for justice is dynamic. It's changing. It changes as a person's power increases or diminishes. That call for justice is going to be changing. So you can't just fix it and say, this is justice, and this is the way justice is, and if it's other than this, it must be unjust. One of the ways to look at this, many times in our history, there have been people who had to trespass against laws, which is an injustice. But they trespassed on the basis of a superior law. And so we have people in the civil rights movement standing up against laws that were unjust laws. and saying on the basis of me being a person of God, this is ridiculous. And so standing up and deliberately going against the laws, performing a, quote, an injustice or being, you know, on the society, but moving ahead and acting on the call of a superior law, a creative justice. One way to put that is that it's a loving justice. It's a justice that really seeks to reunite. So love can be an element of creative justice. Because sometimes our laws and our what we call as our system of justice is not something that reunites, that reunites the estranged, that brings together the separated people, but rather it keeps us in separation. And sometimes there's creative justice calls for moving beyond that. I think one of the best forms of that is justified by grace through faith. No one is justified. Now, you might be the most unjust person in the world, but God proclaims us as just. That kind of standing up. One of the interesting maybe stories on this that I'll try to go through quickly is this past Advent, a woman friend of ours was telling us about, why did I have to say woman friend? A friend of ours was saying, was talking about a vigil at Bendix Corporation in Detroit. And four of the people got arrested at Bendix, and on Ash Wednesday was their trial. And one of the women who was arrested made the point of she was confronted by the prosecuting attorney, I guess that's what they're called, saying, "But don't you see that it was illegal for you to be standing on their property, for you to be going into their building? That's trespassing. That's against the law." And kind of her response was stepping up more and that level of a superior law, saying, "But what they're doing in there is illegal. What they're doing in there to manufacture the high technology to perform death on the world is illegal. It's unjust." And I think it's that kind of creative justice that steps beyond the bounds of what we might have as a set rule of laws. That's important to see when we're talking about justice. Another thing that I want to mention is justice, when there's justice and power combined. An example that's important to see when we're talking about compulsion and coercion the other day. We were saying that coercion could be creative, which usually got that very negative connotation to it. But one way where justice and power are important, where that in coercion or in compulsion or force, there needs to be the reality that comes out of that is that it's actually being forced upon somebody for the fulfillment of that person, to help that person grow in their own realization of who they are. But let's look at that, how it can be negative in a totalitarian state. The people who come to power sometimes have the belief that they're going to be helping the people of their country fulfill their basic needs. But so often in a totalitarian state is that just falls apart, that the people are not being fulfilled. In fact, they're being regimented, they're being restricted in their actualization of themselves. As a people, they're not able to move out and be the people they were called to be. But instead, they're restrained under this force. And so in that sense, it becomes unjust. But one of the that it becomes an unjust power. But power as force does not necessarily have to be unjust. That's kind of what we were talking about a little last week. Force can be part of creative justice, can be part of justice. The other thing I wanted to tie in with justice, I think this is finally it, is the whole idea of justice in love. And that so often love is a chaotic self-surrender. That we give ourselves. Oh, let me give myself to you. In a relationship between two people who are very closely tied together, whether that's marriage or friendship, for one to say, "I don't need justice. I've got love, and that just lets me give myself over to you." In a sense, that's chaotic. And in a sense, that destroys the person who gives himself over. Because when love and justice are combined, it's essential that each person their power of being, their power of life is not weakened, is not taken away from them. Their self-affirmation is there as primary and not just given away to be succumbed by another. John?
Is that implying then that one cannot have love unless there is justice?
I'm saying you can't separate them. I'm saying that love...
But then it seems to me that in that case, then Jesus' command to love your enemies is impossible.
How do you
say
that?
Your enemies are not going to be just to you.
No, I'm saying that I need to be just to myself. In this case, I'm looking at it more like in a relationship of love. Let's take it on first in a personal relation. In a relationship of love, to just give myself over and to lose my own identity, my own self-affirmation for the sake of you, to let you fulfill yourself, that's destructive. It's destructive in two ways. One is that you never learn to see me as an ego. I'm almost denying you that purpose. I'm that potential in life. I never let you see my needs. I never let you see me as a person like you might be. The other thing is that when love is just a total surrender of ourselves, my power as a person, my life as a person, is diminished in my pursuit for what I would call love, in my total giving up. My pursuit, or the form in which I am a person, is destroyed, becomes unjust if I'm not actualizing myself. I need to be actualizing myself in a love relationship and also giving, but if I'm not actualizing myself in a love relationship, I've got to watch that I'm being unjust to myself. I don't know if that makes sense.
Does that relate more than to mutual relationships of love than it does to situation where your enemies might not love you back?
In that case, it was, yeah. My first example was in a love relationship between two quote lovers, whether that's friends or... And John, go on with that point, though.
Well, I'm thinking that self-actualization is something that we may not be able to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's wonderful if we can, but I think that a person can give of themselves without self-negation. And I think that's what I'm getting the feeling that you're talking about the two being mutually exclusive. You can't give of yourself without negating yourself.
Yeah.
I don't think that's true.
Right. One of the things I was going to eventually get to also is that in a relationship of justice and love, it might mean that part of my giving in that relationship is just being able to listen and to give up my life. My giving might be as small as just acknowledging you as another person, as a person of God. It might lead to the extreme case of me surrendering my life literally for you, which really is, you know, denying my life. So I think in that sense there is still that when we demand justice for ourselves, we still can give of ourselves, and even to the point of giving our death, even of, you know, to use that passage, of humbling ourselves to the point of death. That's still all a part of justice. It's where we run around, and there's many people who do that, run around totally absorbed in fulfilling other people's lives and not really having, I guess I return back to the solitude day, not ever having or not ever experiencing what they're all about and what they need in their life.
You're talking about us?
Self-destructive martyrdom, I would think.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait, is John? Maybe if we pursue this, can we pursue it?
You changed your pronouns there, and I got confused.
Okay.
I think I know what you're talking about, but it's...
Let's Eric go, and then we'll continue, and then let's come back to that, because I think we've got to clarify that.
I'd like to speak to it. Some distinctions you've made that are, it seems to me those are words that in a sense are getting at the same thing from a different angle. And for example,
okay.
There is no, well, one could say love is the affirmation of power. Self-love is the affirmation of power in yourself. Love of others is the affirmation of power in them. And one could claim that from a religious perspective, that, well, in the world there seems to be a dichotomy or a tension, an antagonism between love of others and love of oneself. That these are competing things. But it seems to me that the Christ love your neighbor as yourself claims that in fact that appearance is illusory, and that you can you cannot love your neighbor more than you are able to love yourself. Self-abnegation does not empower you to love your neighbor more. You can't do that. And likewise, you can't realize yourself apart from others. Self-realization is different from self-assertion. So that even listening, things where I'm not coming on aggressively can be forms of self-realization, self-actualization, though they're not forms of self-assertion. And that justice is the way we define self-love and the relation of self-love and love of neighbor. Justice is our definition, our understanding of those two things, because they've both got to be affirmed, and they both seem to be competing. They've both got to be confirmed, or they're both destroyed. The woman's issue, men tyrannizing over women does not enhance the self-realization of men. It diminishes. There's the appearance that one is gaining, the other's losing. Actually, both are losing.
Okay. What I'm thinking is we're on a development of looking at justice, and maybe a justice is one of the, but we're also bringing in the concept of love and power here, and I think it's what I, maybe if we move into just looking at those three more in the line of the way you were talking and how they are united in personal relationship, it might clarify some of that, John, because I don't think I did it well. I think Eric did a lot better than I did.
I don't know if I did. Does that speak? I was trying to speak to the issue you raised. Does that not speak to it, or
are you talking to me, Eric?
Yeah. I was addressing the issue I thought you raised, or not.
Yeah, I think it was addressing. I think it was saying, in other words, sort of what I was saying. So.
Yeah. One of the things, maybe just to end with the justice part and move into the dynamics of the three, is that justice toward ourself, if we're just being individuals, is in a sense to actualize our potential, actualize as much of our potential as possible. And that might mean to the point of self-sacrifice of our own life, in a sense. That can be all part of that. The thing I want to jump into, we don't have a lot of time, and I want to get through this kind of fast, is the unity of love, power, and justice in personal relations. And with this, I might be referring to group relations also, because I want to handle two things at one time rather than spending a drawn-out amount of time on this tomorrow. But one of the things in a personal relationship, I think when we're encountering individuals, is that we become people. We become a person, an individual, an ego, whatever kind of word you want to throw in there, when we're in encounter with another person, meeting another one, meeting a thou, another life, another person. And what that's going to mean is that we come to the realization when we meet another person is not that we're just finite, that we can be, that we're people who don't live on forever, but that when we meet another person, there's also some limits set up there, because other people demand things of us. And that might be, like I mentioned before, as little of a demand as just accept me or see me as another person. But so often what happens is we might try to remove the demands of another person, turn that person into an object or a tool. But one of the things that often happens when we try to deny a person its personhood, a person's power in the, to be a person, is that their resistance will inevitably come out of that. And I think when we see a lot of the uprisals in the third world, I think a lot of examples of that, where people have been put down upon by a system, this would be more in line of group, are put down by one group to be used as a tool, whether that's forced labor, whether that's that there are little brown brothers, you know, like that movie in the Philippines, where they're just objects. They're not up to our capacity. But what comes out of that eventually is resistance, because we don't appreciate being used as tools, as objects, not treated as people who have power, who need to be actualized, who need to realize their potential to be a human being. And so that's part of the dynamic that's going on there. One of the things that the golden rule was just mentioned, I guess Tillich in one of his sections pointed out that's in a way can be unjust, this golden rule that we call for. It can really be an unjust rule. Because what it so often can do is love your neighbor as you would have them love you. I guess we can begin to lay on our neighbors things that we want, and maybe what we want for ourselves and how we want the world to treat us is really very unjust. I wanted to give an example of a corporate use of that. I guess when it's the ability, I think, the way we have to counter ourselves to that golden rule is the ability to say, hey, I don't need that power. Sure, you might expect that in your life you need a $25,000 a year job, and that's justice to you, and but don't lay that on me. That's the way you might want yourself to be treated, but don't lay that on me. Kind of in a sense, we need in some ways to deny and to say no to someone trying to be overly generous to us or trying to treat us as they would want themselves treated. In some ways, we need to be able to resist that that golden rule. Not just not saying the golden rule is wrong always, but in some places it can be unjust. Three things I just wanted to mention about creative justice and tying it in with love and justice is that there's three things that's essential in allowing love and justice to be creatively intertwined, I think. And Tillich mentions the first one is being listening. The combination of love and justice comes through in the act of listening so that we know what is just for a person and for a group of people. The typical missionary would come into a land and say, this is what's the way it should be, and never listen to the people, the indigenous people of a place. I always bring this into urban ministry. We want to come into the urban centers and we want to bring Christianity to these people. In our church, most often, it's bringing Christianity in someone besides a white, middle-class person. And really what we need to do most in the cities is if we're doing ministry is to just go there and listen and learn and see the demand of justice by people that we usually would not understand. And so when love and justice are combined, it takes a lot of listening. It takes a lot of reaching in and trying to find out and letting one talk to us. One example in personal encounters that I think is a way to look at it is someone may be a very resistive person, just resisting everything and not wanting to do this and not wanting to do that. And really, at the very basis of that, when we begin to listen to someone like that, there might be a lot of loneliness there. And all we see is belligerence and force, in a sense. But when we learn to listen, I think it's a form of justice and love, because that's when we begin to see what the real power is there and what the real need for actualization is. Another function of creative justice, which is love, is giving. And this is where I think, John, we get into the self-sacrifice. And that's a person demands from me. When I'm with someone, a person demands from me. Even if it's just the point of accepting that person as another person. The story that comes to mind, I read it somewhere with, I guess it was Martin Buber, and he was talking about a person he met on a train, and you know, the guy was carrying a conversation. He really wasn't dealing with this person very much and wasn't really paying much attention. And later he finds out that this person had killed himself. We need to listen. We need to be able to give even our attention. But we need to also, sometimes a person or a group of people will demand that I give even my life for the sake of the integrity and the just living and the ability for those people to realize themselves. I may need to give my life. And so when justice and love are combined, there's an element of giving there. I think that's where the creative justice of Jesus Christ comes in, as one who gives even his life. And at the same time, it may mean we need to resist and restrain someone. We would need to confront someone. What they want might be very destructive, and we need to, in a sense, give our admonition. Finally, I think that, and for me, the most dynamic part of justice, creative justice, what I would call biblical justice, is the whole act and life of forgiving. And I think it's most exemplified in Justified by Grace. To be able to allow that person to be that person. To say yes when everything says no. The only way that we can help make a person a part of a community, especially people who are estranged by the guilt of their own life, the rottenness of themselves as individuals, is through forgiveness as a power, as an element of creative justice. Because it's only in forgiving that we finally can help bring people back into a unity in which they feel separated and estranged. And a lot of, and in the case of humanity, I would say that that's us all. And so the need for mutual forgiveness in a community of power or love and justice. Finally, before I'm gonna stop for a little bit, is the whole encounter of then justice and power in relationships. And one of the things that creative justice calls for is that no one is denied their encounter with another one. That everyone is given the opportunity to realize who they are in a group. I think that's what's so vital about nursery schools and having kids play together. It's where these children begin to be in encounter with one another, begin to see other people and the demands that other people have upon them, even if that's just with playing with blocks and ripping off some Legos or something. But creative justice says that's where you go, you know. And I think that's when the Holy Spirit is so much spiritualized as being something outside of our everyday life, where we lock ourselves in a closet, or it's just in a worship that we express this. I think the Holy Spirit is that which pushes Jesus out of the wilderness, back into the world, and it does the same thing to us. It's creative in that it makes me as a power, empowered by God, pushed right into the middle of all the other powers. It doesn't take me away from that, because it's in that where justice is going to be lived out. How can you be just if you're not in encounter with people? How can you be just if you're not there listening and seeing the demands of people around you? A need to move out and struggle. Struggle with what is just. Now, what's going on here in this relationship? Is it, whether it's a personal relation or a relationship of groups, it's so important that we struggle, and that justice calls for that. Calls for a struggling so we know how to act out our forms of power so that they're not destructive to other people. And when we do that, there's going to be decisions made about the power of one person, the power of another person. And it's not unjust for one person or one group of people to actualize more power. I mean, I definitely, when I'm in the presence of some people, I'm just amazed at the power they have. Is it unjust that they do that? That my power isn't as great as theirs? No, that kind of thing doesn't matter. It's where that if someone who has, quote, superior power or is able to actualize themselves some more, or a group that's able to be a powerful group, it's okay for them to be powerful. But when they're powerful on the backs of other people, when they're powerful by diminishing other groups and other people's attempt to realize themselves as human beings, that's where it becomes unjust. And that's where it becomes destructive. And that's where it starts to break away and not be loving, because it doesn't reunite, but it separates. And so there's a real tension there that needs to always be, in our relationships. With when we're talking about power and justice, it's okay to be a powerful person, to be able to actualize that, or to be a powerful group. But if you do that at the expense of, I think that's dangerous. I think one example of that is authority in principle, or power in principle. To give the Pope all this power just by the basis of an office, that's unjust. That's one example. To give Bishop Preuss or Bishop Crumley power by authority is unjust. Because it's justice needs to be in dialogue, it needs to be a part of a dynamic. And that needs to be worked out anew in every situation. To give authority in principle to a dictator oftentimes comes about as being something that's unjust in authority. Even parents, when children are smaller, the parents take a lot of authority and do a lot of guiding. But when the little child is now 32 years old and the parent's still trying to throw all this authority and this manipulation on a child who is now an adult simply because of their authority as a parent, authority becomes unjust. Okay, I'm pretty much done. I could do something with group relations here. Maybe the most important thing I think in resistance for me, which is part of peacemaking, is that so often in groups we personify a group, like the body of Christ, or even countries. We personify them as everybody's pulling their part, being a part of their country, being a part of their nation. And that might be good in some ways, but in a lot of ways what it does is it tells you we're all supposed to be a part of the body. Why don't you conform? But one of the things about individuals is that when any nation tries to get its people to conform, when that conforming means that I as an individual am not going to be free to be a person, then individuals will resist. Individuals will say no. Individuals will speak out, and even to the point of giving themselves for the sake of being, for the sake of not being under this compromise. And I guess I'd end that with an example. In Nazi Germany, we could probably even use the case of the American Indians. But when you use a group to personify, when you personify a whole group, that would mean the whole group would be responsible. But in a case like Nazi Germany, it was only the officials who were, some of the officials who were held accountable for their moral guilt, and they were the ones that were sentenced. And where it breaks down is we did not, and we do not hold the people responsible. Because we as individuals are responsible to the holocausts of our day simply because we say yes and don't say no. Simply because we allow what is happening to happen. And so in a sense, we are being unjust. As individuals, even though I'm separated and I'm not part of the ruling body of our land, that we have representatives that go and do that, in the case of Holocaust, it's not just them that did it, it's us. And it's us who need to be the power that resists that. And it's why the peace movement isn't just something that sits back, but that peacemaking is involved in a resistance, a saying no, a standing in the face of, even to the point of like John Nelson, going to prison. Even to the point of putting some, for some people, putting some small boats out in front of a trident. If you don't say no, you're saying an awful big yes, even though you're saying nothing. And I think that's one of the things that really comes down to me more and more, and I think in our day, in the midst of nuclear armament. With that, I have some things with one of the ways this is all actualized for me, I guess, this combination and this emphasis for justice has the place where it does that for me is in the city. City is oftentimes a place that is put down, a place that is supposedly evil in itself, violent in itself, unjust in itself, evil in itself. And for me, the city is a place, I think, in which the Spirit teaches me to be one of peacemaking. That's why I kind of would have labeled, if I would have done more, this whole section on city spirit or urban spirit, where it's there that the Spirit teaches me to be with. Because so often in our cities, since for the most part, the majority of this nation has run out of the city, or because of the influx of minorities in the city, being in the city has taught me as a middle-class white person with white values and middle, more than that, middle-class economic values, the Spirit leads me, and I think it leads our church, to be with other people, to be in solidarity, to contextualize ourselves. We can go back to those things I mentioned earlier about adequacy, equality, liberty, personality. Whereas so often the church, this I would speak particularly to the American Lutheran Church, that's the only one I know of the most, is we tend to have missions all over the world. We tend to spring up missions in third, fourth ring suburbs and out farther into the resort areas of our land. But the mission money of the city, it's like it's okay to lose that because there's no more of us there. There's only some churches with 60 people in the city. You want us to give them $20,000? I think the church needs to give those congregations that money in order that the church in its entirety might learn from the experience of being a be-with church rather than a masterful church. A church that listens. Not that they're going to be hearing a church that listens to other cultures. That we gain the gift of being not just our own race, but the gift of being biracial in a sense. John.
I'm a member of one of those dying inner city congregations, and I think your solution there is a bit overly simple. There are at least 16 Lutheran congregations in North Minneapolis, of which about only two I would say would really be benefiting the people you're talking about if you gave that money. All the rest of them, mine included, are churches where the membership has fled to the suburbs, but they retain their membership and guard it jealously, and there's no interest whatsoever in relating to the outside community that surrounds the church. And so that money, if it went into those churches, would go into our building organs.
Right.
And other things which would aid the church infrastructure, but would not be mission necessarily. That my guess would be that it would not get to mission.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think in a situation like that, because that's the kind of congregation I was involved with, I don't see peacemaking happening there. I guess I'd come back. I think for the church to take the gifts of the city, we need to be willing to confront that reality. Yeah, that's true. I think if a church like that was given money, yes, it would go for everything but listening. It would go with everything but giving. I really agree with what you're saying there. I wouldn't mean to be saying something different. But I think at the same time, we give ourselves an excuse not to be in the city. I think we need to be in the city solely for the gift of the city, the gift of those people that we're not anything like. And that, again, I think you brought the point once before, that's not all positive. There's lots of negative about the city. But there's lots of gift in the city. I think it's important for the church to begin to contextualize, for a congregation like that to begin to see its place in a context, to begin to be involved with that context rather than with their reality out in the suburb and driving in. It's okay, I think, to be a suburban person in an urban situation if you're willing to listen to the context. Go ahead.
I have a further illustration of what's going on there. I said that there are two congregations which seem to be actually listening. One of them was a mission congregation. It was specifically put in there in the housing projects area in North Minneapolis as a ministry to the predominantly black community there, and has in a number of ways succeeded in that. The other one is one of those churches which essentially they had to die to be born again. It's a somewhat overused terminology there. They had gotten down to a membership of under 50 members, and their pastor had told them, had suggested that they merge with the other point in the parish. There was a dual pastorate there. And this church said, no, we're going to stay together. And so the pulpit was empty for a year and a half. And that caused them to have to think very hard. And they decided they were not going to disband as a church. But what has happened is that they have had, they finally did get a pastor for about 2/3 time. And he is a person who is very interested in outreach. He grew up in the slums of Chicago and his interest in social ministry has been perfect for the situation because these people are ready to have to reach the community. And last I heard, they had about 130 members, and these new members were not people who had been dragged in from suburban numbers. They were people from the community there. It's one of the few signs of hope that I see there. They had to get to the point where they just were confronted by their problems. My church hasn't gotten there yet. They're still pretty comfortable.
I think that that's a... I think that could be a good example of the relationship of these elements of peacemaking in a congregational setting like that, where there's different races coming together, different ethnic backgrounds coming together. In that, I think part of what we need to do as traditional white bastions in the city is to not make that the ground of Christianity. That it is these kinds of hymns, it is this structure, it is this church as it has been church, which is the church. We need to be able to maybe to give that up, or to give some of that up as legality, and allow for some different ways of experiencing Christ in life. And I think that's where we learn to listen in the city. I think the other thing that's important is that, like, that our involvement in a city isn't just that of self-surrender. Oh, yeah, I'm no good. Teach me the way I should be. But rather that we hold up something that is important. And I think oftentimes for me in Lutheranism, I think what's important is our biblical interpretation that needs to be a part of the urban context in a serving way. I think we need to be very strongly biblical and critically biblical in a context that possibly there might not be as much criticism as we use in our scripture, but at the same time, accepting the parts of those other cultures that can enhance our being in the city. If that's worship, if that's it's strange for me to say if that's worship, but if it's anything, I think the most important thing for me in the city when I was there was to shut up for the first 6 months I was there and do a lot of street walking, a lot of going to community organization meetings, and for one, sitting on a community organization board. That was a funny thing. If you're the pastors in the community were on the board automatically, kind of because it had a church base to this community organization. But and they're kind of they're just as figureheads to be involved and not to take over. But one of the interesting things that I learned from the, sitting on that community organization board was to hear the people who my initial reaction, if you remember last time, we talked about when you walk into a room, just the glances, you make power evaluations. Well, my initial reaction, my initial glances, my initial getting to meet some of these people was very, I had my prejudice just came up and my racism just came up over me. But listening to them, I've never been given such a great gift as some of the people that I met in the city that I first put a prejudice upon. I think some of the most articulate people and the wisest people now I give as images, when I want to talk about someone who's wise, were some of those people that I had initially had this huge prejudice against because of their color. I think the church needs to be willing to just be there. And that might even mean be there just to serve and not to get money out of them. One of the first things I often hear in mission conversations is the church growing? Do you have enough, you know, how many members do you see yourself getting in 3 years? I think for once, maybe we've got to look at being in the city as just a place to be and to serve. You know, just a place to take on and to be a part of this dynamic of people. Yeah, and the intensity of that in the city.
Like to throw another shift of emphasis, because there's, we come down on one part of the city, and that's the inner city. People in need, people dispossessed, and meeting them, and that kind of theology of cross sort of thing. But surely, in that frame of things, one of the great things about the city is that middle thing of power. In a city, you find many forms of gifts and talents realizing themselves. There's not just slums in the inner city.
Right.
There are theaters. There are restaurants, there are art shows, there are concerts, there are all forms. I mean, why were cities developed? They weren't, I mean, inner city, when we talk about modern American cities collapsing, those are dying cities. Those were not cities were not invented to throw the poor and the dispossessed, you know, together into ghettos. They were born because of a lot of human beings coming together and discovering that there was a kind of multiplication of gifts, of self-realization, when you bring densities of populations together, and that you can simultaneously in the city realize your particular talent and be stimulated by a lot of different talents. And, and I don't want to, you know, deny the inner city mission, but I think when one talks about mission in the city, or, you know, grace within the city, it's got to include more than black ghettos.
Right.
And I think in abandoning cities, the middle class has given up not just that pain, but all that beauty. They spend their times out in shopping centers, mm-hmm. going to movies and eating in pizza parlors, and that's their cultural life.
That's the other part I think that I was going to emphasize was the city as gift. Not just, you know, I think being in the city, part of the gift of being in the city is being with the people who are there. Whether that is the poor, whether that is the ones who are racially different than us. But I think being in the city too is, just that there's all that, the gifts of the greater culture that are so oftentimes centered in the city. The one thing that I think is a danger when we highlight that so much is I can be very middle class, very racist, and very classist, I think that may be the most word, and still be in the city. By living in the city, I don't become one who is in solidarity with the poor in the city, but I can still implant my middle classness, which I think is a very big separating wall between many of the people in the city and, let's say, traditional European churches, because European churches are traditionally more economically stable people, especially like Lutherans, Episcopalians, that, than some of the poor people in the city. And I guess what I really see the city as gift, and what you're saying is the cultural part of that. I really would affirm that. That we can take advantage of that. We don't have to. I used to always laugh at people coming in to see a big cultural activity downtown, and they would come into Detroit on the freeways, and it would be packed on the freeways. You couldn't move 10 miles an hour, and if you wanted to get downtown, just go right down Woodward. Use a surface street. But the predominant amount of people coming in from the suburbs didn't want to use the surface streets. You know what neighborhoods they go through? And in a sense, that it's a freeing gift to be in the city, to have those things so close, and to be able to take to make use of them, and to use as use those as part of a gift. I guess another gift that I see in the city is the whole gift of vision, because in the simple lack of lighting in a neighborhood, I began to see more of the systemic evil of the city. Where that, to make our city beautiful and attractive, we wanted to build condominiums downtown near the cultural center, and so people were being displaced, thousands and millions of dollars going into beautifying the center downtown so that people will begin to move back in and do their shopping back in, mainly those who are in the middle and upper classes. But the neighborhoods in the city needed some lighting. They needed some rat control. They needed some garbage pickup. No, that'll come. We're more concerned with building a very nice lighting system in the downtown area. And what I heard people saying is, but I want my street lit. And I began to see the vision these people had just by their position of being the oppressed. And the vision I'm talking about is the vision to see through the system, to see what they're getting at, to know that when they're talking about urban renewal, they're talking about moving the poor and black and Hispanic out. To know that, to be able to just see that, and not to dilly-dally with the arguments, well, this is really going to be a good improvement for the city. Oh yeah, it might be. And you can say that, oh, we're going to allow 10% of these houses to be occupied by the poor. But in reality, it's, I think, a gift of vision that is gotten in the city by being with the people who usually would say are the other class, the other race, those that we refer to as other and keep at arm's length from us. I think there's a gift there that I hope to experience more. And I think that's why I call the city and urban life a place of the spirit, because it forces us into those encounters.